Mr. Chairman and friends, theosophy can answer that very pressing problem of justice for us all. Justice in the face of so much apparent and even bitter injustice in the experiences of men and women and of nations. Theosophy has been defined as a practical philosophy of life which is consistent with the scientific method of thought. And one part of the great appeal of theosophy to the student consists of its strictly logical answers to the many problems of human life. Take the one with which I am now going to deal. Justice for man on earth. Fair play for man. The existence of undeserved human suffering, especially of newborn children, does seem to be a denial of divine justice. The poet Dryden posed this question by saying, "Virtue in distress and vice in triumph make atheists of mankind." Is human life based upon justice or upon chance or luck, good, bad, or indifferent, especially when it first begins on earth? Or is there indeed law, justice, logic in all the events and experiences of every man? Theosophy answers unhesitatingly and positively: law, justice, logic. How then does it explain apparent injustices, as for example, when a baby is born blind, deaf, dumb, diseased, malformed, mentally deficient? How can there be justice, fair play in that? Theosophy answers, and I can only give you the answer now in brief. Theosophy says the soul of such a child has been born on earth before, has committed sins in a former life, and is reaping in the new life as it has sown in a preceding one. And all this under the unbreakable and strictly just law of cause and effect. This idea should not be new to us who belong to the Christian fold. St. Paul was proclaiming pure theosophy when he said, "God is not mocked, for whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap." And our Lord also said, you will remember, "It is easier for heaven and earth to pass than one tittle of the law to fail." True, since we cannot remember our former lives in which transgressions occurred, bringing sorrow, or good deeds were performed, bringing happiness, in the lives of nations we can look back into their past history and see whether the law of cause and effect can be discerned at work in all the events which occur for nations. Let us then look at this problem of justice from the more national point of view now. The history of nations does pose many problems. How was it, for example, that in the two world wars of this century, both Belgium and France suffered so heavily, whilst Sweden and Switzerland were immune? How was it that whilst war raged all about those two countries, neither of them was drawn into the conflict? Why, it might also be asked, were Germany and Italy vanquished and their dictators, Hitler and Mussolini, disgraced and execrated. What can there have been in the past history and actions of these and other nations and people to explain such a strange diversity of experience in the midst of a general European conflagration? Let us look at this subject, interesting subject, together. It is very important, as I think you will agree, for if we can find the root cause of the sufferings, the losses, the victories and the defeats of some nations in war and of the immunity in others, then we shall have found the key to the arrangement and attainment of peace, both within ourselves and for the world. According to Theosophy, that key is the existence and continual operation of the law of cause and effect. Under this law, nations and their leaders create their own destiny, and largely by former actions decide their own victories or defeats. Theosophy teaches, as you will see, that both national and personal experience contain neither chaos nor chance. On the contrary, order and law everywhere prevail. Now, let us look at some nations. Take Germany, for example. Germany made itself an object of interest, as also of terror, to the nations of the world. She's done that twice, hasn't she? The study of her history reveals that in Germany we have an excellent example of the operation of the law of cause and effect. Let us look back a little into her history. In the 18th century, Frederick the Great initiated the national policy of unprovoked and wanton aggression. Temporarily, he succeeded, gaining in addition Silesia and other German territory. Bismarck continued this course of action. He, too, found it to be temporarily profitable, having acquired Schleswig-Holstein and Alsace-Lorraine as a result. Unprovoked aggression had become part of German national policy. But when in 1914, William II the Kaiser pursued that same policy, he came to grief and brought disaster to his country. That, however, strangely enough, how slowly we learn, that did not prevent Hitler from carrying it to a still higher pitch of effrontery and faithlessness, bringing still greater suffering to his country and defeat, worldwide execration and death to himself and many of his close associates. Even whilst I speak to you, some of them are either still in punishment or being tried. Thus, from the records of history, we are able to observe the action of the law of causation. Wanton aggression inevitably brings national death and disintegration. Tyranny carries its own end within itself. Both constitute violations of natural as well as divine law. Both tyranny and wanton aggression therefore bring their own nemesis, their own inevitable punishment to those who are guilty of them. Now let us take another nation. Let us take, for example, Belgium. How was it that Belgium suffered so heavily? In both world wars, can we find in her history aggressive conduct and wanton cruelty inflicted upon weaker peoples, and of such a nature and on such a scale as would seem to justify, according to the principle of cause and effect, her subsequent military disasters? Yes, I think we can. with every respect to the noble Belgian people, I would draw attention to what have come to be known by historians as the Belgian Congo atrocities. I'm not going to describe in detail these products of the purely colonial administration of the Belgian government of the time, but I would refer those of you who are interested and who wish to, well, test this theory that I'm propounding, I would refer them to the official records and photographs illustrating the barbarous treatment meted out to the indigenous population of the Belgian Congo colonies. Really, friends, they were terrible atrocities. From these, it may reasonably be deduced that the Congo atrocities constituted a sowing from which the later national disasters were a not inappropriate reaping, to use the analogy of St. Paul. Now, what about France? Well, there's another country which has been three times invaded and twice defeated and occupied by the Germans. Can we also find deeds in earlier epochs which could be regarded justly as sowings from which later tribulations were the just and appropriate reapings? Yes, again, I really think we can. For a long time, like Britain and other European nations, France was one of the great feudal countries of Europe. For centuries, royalty and aristocracy obtained their power and their wealth at the cost of the masses, including the large peasant population. Long-continued exploitation and oppression were inflicted upon a poor and relatively helpless people. Then there was that awful event in France, wasn't there? The massacre of the Huguenots on St. Bartholomew's Eve in 1572. This was really one of the most brutal of the many religious persecutions recorded in the whole history of Christendom. The royalty and the aristocracy of France had long therefore been sitting upon the volcano of a national bitterness and the rebellion of the masses. This erupted as the French Revolution of 1789, and then the forces of brutality, bloodshed, and barbarism were liberated. Even after that there came the terrible Napoleonic Wars. These wars spread disaster and death throughout the many countries which Napoleon invaded. And then there's that terrible penal colony of French Guiana, known appropriately as Devil's Island, and the penal ships which took the miserable victims to it. These were for a long time the cause of intense and widespread human misery. Doesn't it seem reasonable to assume that from these sanguinary sowings, the subsequent national tribulations were a natural reaping under the causative law? I think so. I think it would seem permissible to conclude that in the case of France, as also in Belgium, the operation of the law of cause and effect can be clearly discerned. Now let us take another nation. Shall we say Spain? The history of Spain has been a very dramatic one. In the Middle Ages, as you remember, this country was on the threshold of world empire. She owned colonies in the Americas, the Philippines, and the West Indies. She was enabled twice to build the greatest armada the world had known up to that time. Then, almost in a night, her fall began. The great ships were wrecked on the shores of Britain, the very country she set out to defeat. For, as historians have said, God sent a wind. Truly, Drake, his ships, and his men, and his magnificent strategy also contributed. But the storm of those days and knights admittedly played a large part in the defeat of the First Armada. I wish I had time, but I haven't, to talk over with you the part that the weather, almost unaccountably but very dramatically, plays in history. But I mustn't digress too far, interesting though it is. Is the weather a matter of chance, or is there in operation there a law of cause and effect? Well, to return to Spain, the Armada defeated, Spain's decline was rapid. Soon afterwards, she lost her colonies. In recent years, she has been ravaged by a civil war, and for a long time has not been considered worthy of admission to the family of nations gathered together as the United Nations. This is a decline indeed from a once proud position as a world power. What's the explanation of this decline? Well, I would say read the history of Spain. Follow the conquistadores, the conquerors, under Pizarro and Cortes, into Mexico and Peru, and see how they and their officers treated the peoples of those countries. Spain's earlier treatment of the Moors and the Jews in their own country left a great deal to be desired, and she was long the home of one of the most brutal and cruel of all human institutions on earth, the Spanish Inquisition. This terrible institution has played so important a part in the history of Europe and has been so notable an example of the depths of sadistic cruelty and bigotry to which humanity can descend that its origin and activities might just be glanced at this point. I'll go on to other nations, but the Inquisition has played a great part in the life, and we say, the karma of Europe. Ah, there I've used a strange word, karma. K-A-R-M-A. Well, that's a Sanskrit word, and used to denote this very law of cause and effect which we are considering. The Spanish Inquisition was organized by Ferdinand V and Isabella, who appointed Thomas de Torquemada in 1420 to 1498 as Inquisitor General of Castile and Aragon, and charged him with the centralization of the Spanish Inquisition in 1463. Terrible things followed. Inhuman cruelty was the means whereby they became infamous for their use of the torture and the harshness of many of the Spanish courts, which brought the Inquisition into general disapprobation. Is it a wonder, then, that with all this cruelty in the history of the Spanish nation, from the Jews and the Moors at home, from the Mexicans, Peruvians, and other Indians in their colonies abroad, and in the Spanish Inquisition, that Spain, under the law of cause and effect, brought about her own tribulations, her own downfall, and her decline from a great power to a position far below that which once she held. Now, Switzerland. Isn't it rather strange that Switzerland was able to maintain neutrality in both the First and the Second World Wars? What's the explanation of that immunity of Switzerland? Has she been so philanthropic as a member of the family of nations, and so benign in her internal administration as to generate freedom from war under the law of cause and effect, or karma? Yes, I think so. Let us look at our history for a moment, remembering, of course, that universal military service does enable Switzerland to enforce respect for her neutrality, but on the other hand, She has performed many internally and internationally beneficent actions. Matters concerning the welfare of the whole state in Switzerland are referred to the votes of all the citizens in a referendum. Switzerland was the first European country to adopt and practice the ideal of democracy. Since 1499, Swiss citizens have been able to breathe freely and discuss questionable matters without fear. Local government is carried on by democratic methods, and in elementary education, Switzerland ranks in advance of the rest of Europe. She successfully solved the problem of welding three diverse races, the German, the French and the Italian, into one great confederacy, quite united and working peacefully for the good of the country as a whole. But this isn't all, far from it. As a neutral state, Switzerland has been the seat of international congresses of the greatest benefit to mankind. One of the earliest of these was concerned with the treatment of the wounded in war. This Congress was held in 1864, and from it there followed great amelioration of the suffering of war victims. The International Postal Congress was held in Bern in 1875. In consequence, almost all nations agreed to carry each other's mail, thus drawing the peoples of the world into a closer relationship with each other, a most valuable contribution. And then, you remember, the League of Nations had its headquarters at Geneva, and that most valuable of secular institutions, the International Red Cross, is also directed from Geneva in Switzerland. Doesn't there seem at least a poetic justice in this sequence of beneficent internal national life combined with actions bringing blessings to the whole of mankind on the one hand, and on the other immunity from war to the country responsible for these good deeds? Here I believe also we can find, justly and logically, an action of just law under which certain kind of beneficent conduct brings peace, immunity from the horrors of war, even though it is being waged on every side. Now, what about Britain? The country which I, who am speaking to you, happen to belong to. Well, Britain has suffered greatly, so we must expect to find some adverse conduct. Britain was involved in both world wars, in which she suffered heavy losses of men and materials. Yet, she was not successfully invaded, and she has emerged from both wars as a victorious nation. Evidently, there have been both helpful and adverse activities in the past, each of which have contributed to the mixed karma of the British nation. Unfortunately, and we'd better face it, Britain's national history is not without its darker pages. England was long the centre of the feudal system. The conduct of the rich and the powerful during the rise of the industrial era left a great deal to be desired. As a colonizing power, some abuses were almost inevitable, and indeed really occurred. One grave error, amongst others, could have contributed to Britain's adversity. It was the slave trade in the new colonies in North America in the reign of Charles II. When the Second Virginia Company was founded in 1606 and tobacco was introduced, Negro slaves were employed. The southern colonies and the tropical West Indian islands needed manpower to work sugar, tobacco, and rice plantations. Thus, the Royal African Company was founded in 1671 in order to ensure a plentiful supply of slaves. The appalling extent of the trade may be gauged when we realize that by 1750, 250 slavers, or slave ships, hailed from the port of Liverpool alone. Support for this reading of history in the light of law, the law of cause and effect which I'm putting before you, is further supplied by the subsequent difficulties experienced in the United States in harmoniously weaving the 13 million Negro descendants of these slaves into the fabric of American social life. Even as I talk to you, the great problem of integration and segregation is not solved, and in one town, Little Rock in Arkansas, the difficulty is quite acute. All the white people will not have the Negro children in that school, even though the federal law has been passed making integration compulsory. A difficult problem which, the theosophist would say, stems back to the old days of the grave ill treatment of the colored people at the time of slavery. Racial cleavage, color riots, and lynchings also constitute an unsolved problem in America, the causative origin of which probably lies far back in the days of the slave trade. Fortunately, England later found her conscience and abolished this trade with compensation to the slave owners. And this great act of national righteousness may be presumed to have modified the adverse effects of the practice of slavery and to have brought national advantages under the law of cause and effect. America did the same, you will remember, and the great President Lincoln, with great difficulty and under heavy opposition, managed to bring about the abolition of slavery in America. And we may be sure that the later benefices which have come to America partly stem from that splendid action. But going back to Britain, there has been much also on the good side. For example, we find that Britain was always a sanctuary for the oppressed. She gave very generous treatment to the Boers after the South African War. She has granted the freedom of religious worship to all her peoples, and everywhere where she has gone, she has introduced the concept and the practice of British law, and this now still obtains wherever British rule has been established. As I said just now, Britain has always been a sanctuary. The Jews, the Flemish weavers, the Huguenots after the massacre at St. Bartholomew's Eve, and by the French aristocracy during the French Revolution. More recently, the Basque children found Britain a sanctuary too. They were brought over to England and kept safe there during the Civil War in Spain, as also, of course, were large numbers of refugees from Europe in both world wars. Towards the end of the second one, Britain was a rallying ground from which the monarchs, the statesmen, and the military leaders and forces of the defeated European nations found the help and the means of recovery of their national sovereignty, all in Britain. Then the Statute of Westminster gave complete freedom of action to the Dominions. And both wars were first entered on behalf of small nations. Thus, if the idea of a principle of cause and effect is applied to British history, a peculiar appropriateness and exactness is discovered in the mixture of suffering and success which has characterized her more recent history. Well, friends, I have been putting forward the idea that justice does actually obtain in the affairs of individual people and of the nations of the world. And if the views which I've been putting forward are at all acceptable, and if, as I believe, they are indeed founded upon fact, then a great discovery has been made. A discovery of the two root causes of human pain and sorrow, individual and national. Evidently, there are two such causes of all human sorrow. How tremendously important if we can discover what they are. And even more so, I suppose, if, having learned the facts, we can refrain from being guilty of those two main causes, amongst others. What are they? What have we learnt from this reading of history? Apparently, the causes of national suffering and disaster are 1. Cruelty, 2. Enslavement, including oppression and domination, whether mental, physical, or both. Cruelty especially, cruelty of man to man, to children, to the aged and to the sick, to those weaker than oneself, cruelty to criminals, man's inhumanity to man. This evidently produces a reaction in kind. This cruelty is a cause which gives rise to an appropriate effect. Then, what a further discovery we've made. If cruelty and enslavement generate suffering, then, under the law, kindness and the giving of freedom must bring happiness. There is the simple truth as put forward by theosophy. Kindness and the protection of the freedom of others, these will inevitably bring health and happiness to those who consistently practice them. So you see, history can teach us a great deal, can provide us with a great religious ideal. How can I express it? Well, something like this. A dual ideal. Obedience to divine law and unfailing kindness in national and individual conduct. A cynic has said that the message of history is that no one learns the message of history. Whilst admitting that unfortunately there is some truth in this statement, I suggest that the central lesson of history, especially that of the immeasurable and long-continued suffering of mankind, that the central lesson of history, when read in the light of compensatory law, is, I am my brother's keeper. Evidently, harmlessness is the secret of happiness. When we apply directly to our conduct, day by day and hour by power as a consistent policy. The gospel of kindness, we shall be able to solve not only our own problems, but the world problems of peace and war and the continual threat of war under which we are living, even as I am speaking to you now. To be kind is to ensure for oneself enduring health, happiness, and peace. To be cruel is to make all of these quite unattainable. Cruelty brings ill health, disease, frustration, and unhappiness. Such indeed is the law. Of course, we don't always want to be thinking of ourselves. We don't want to be kind for the sake of some benefit we're going to receive. We want to be kind, don't we, for kindness' sake, for that is what the world needs today. Warm human understanding, kindness, concern for the welfare, spiritual and material, of other people. And this, in the individual and in the nation, is, I personally believe, and theosophy teaches it, the great secret of serenity, peace of mind, and well-being down here in this world. And this gospel, and here I'm going to close, this gospel of kindness has been beautifully expressed in words pregnant with meaning, despite their apparent simplicity. Here they are, and they will be my last words to you at the end of my attempt to apply with you the doctrine of cause and effect to the history of nations. Here is the simple saying, guidance surely for us all in all our relationships with each other. Always be kinder than the situation demands.